the Gospel of Matthew, the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Luke, and the Gospel of John. Why are these titled the Gospel? What does the Gospel even mean? All throughout Jesus' ministry, he came proclaiming the Gospel. In the book of Acts, the writing of Acts, you have Paul, Barnabas, Peter proclaiming the Gospel. But what exactly is the Gospel? Well, today on Whiskey in the Writings, we're going to dive into this word and really work through it from beginning to end, what this word means and why it should matter to us today. Thanks for joining me on Whiskey in the Writings, a place for the skeptic, the disenfranchised, those who are spiritually curious. They still believe, but maybe just not like they used to. This is a place where you can ask questions, wrestle with your faith in safe and in transparent ways. My name is Joe Oliver, and for the past 24 years, I've been in pastoral ministry. I have a master's degree in biblical theology, and if you have questions, you're in the right place. Let's get started. So today, everyone, we're going to be looking at this word called the Gospel. It's actually going to take multiple videos to get through this because I've really been working through and thinking about what it actually means to believe the Gospel, to maybe teach the Gospel. What did it mean to Jesus? What did it mean to a first century Christian who was hearing the Gospel for the very first time, and how did they self-reflect on it? How did the early New Testament writers use this word Gospel, and what kind of historical and cultural context did this word actually mean to everyone around them? And so this is a big topic, and I anticipate taking a couple videos to actually work through this. So if you've been wondering, you read the beginning of the four biographies of Jesus, and they are all titled Gospel, and you're like, what is that? And if you've dove into it, if you've been in church for any period of time, and they say to you, just preach the Gospel, do we actually understand what that word means? I think we can find out. And in this video and a few more to come, we're going to dive into what all this word means, where it came from, and what impact it has for us today. So thanks for joining me on today's episode of Whiskey in the Writings. Before we dive into our topic, we're going to introduce our whiskey. Here we go. So today we're drinking some Blanton's bourbon. This is kind of like the kind of whiskey you drink when you're trying to impress people that you like whiskey. And I say that because it's gotten so popular, and yet for me, it's kind of a mid whiskey. It's not that it's bad, but it's not that it's like the best thing out there. I think it's one of those kinds of whiskeys that you just have on the shelf and it looks really good. There are people that collect these toppers. They've got the horse riders on the top coming out of Kentucky. And there's lots of different collecting that happens with these tops where people buy the different Blanton versions to get the different tops. And it's kind of a thing to have them all. A little bit of Pokemon going on there. Got to catch them all. So that's what I'm drinking. I have this on my shelf. Again, not because it's particularly my favorite thing in the world, but I remember when my daughter was getting married and I wanted to give them something nice. And so I had never really had Blanton's before. I'd bought a bottle one Christmas for my brother-in-law, Josh, gave it to him, but I never really had it. And so I bought some for them for their wedding day so that they could have something nice to open up. And then I saw an extra bottle on the shelf, so I bought it for me. And I've been slowly working on it. I like to share it with people. I don't typically like to just drink this on my own. So it's something that I share with people. And I've had this for quite some time now, and I'll probably get another bottle in the future. But when you drink this, it's going to have your normal notes of a little bit of burn, softer on the back end. There is some good flavor in there. Again, not the most flavorful whiskey I've ever had that I enjoy, but still a good one to drink with some friends or some family or whoever you're with. So whatever you've got in front of you, pour your drink, drink responsibly, and let's dive in to this topic that we have for us today. Cheers. Okay, so we are talking about the gospel. Now, I need to give some clarification here on a couple things before we dive in. There's going to be a lot of me probably thinking through thoughts with you because I'm pretending that you're in the room with me and I'm having a conversation and maybe you ask the question, Joe, what does the gospel mean? I could just jump out with a simple statement. And I think that's where I'm going to land this conversation with me saying, this is what I think the gospel is. But that might be like video three for me because I want to do some work, truly understand what's happening behind the scenes, because you see it everywhere in the New Testament, this word. Now, depending on what translation you're reading, you might see it worded a different way. So for instance, I like to read out of the NET, the New English Translation Version. And in the NET, it's going to use the word good news. In something like an older version, you might get the word gospel. And so depending on what version you might get in front of you, you're going to see an interchangeable word, whether it's good news, like you're going to hear me talk about today, or the word gospel, which is the same thing from the Greek. They're choosing to translate a specific Greek word to either gospel or good news, trying to get at the root of what that word gospel means, which is a little bit of a giveaway, but there's more to it than that. And so when I read, I'm going to be reading out of the NET, and so you're going to get a lot of the word good news in replace of gospel. And so I hope that doesn't trip you up too much, but I want to say that out of the beginning because I probably won't say the word gospel a whole lot because the NET doesn't use that word. It uses good news. But here's why I decided on going on this video was because I was reading in my devotions. I'm going through Acts in my own personal devotion. And when I read in my own devotional time, I read out of what's called the Lectio Bible, which I did a video on and wrote an article about in a previous video. I can link to that in the show notes. And if you're curious about purchasing it, I'll link to it as well in the show notes. But the Lectio Bible, it's just a Bible that removes all the chapters and verses to try to give you more of a streamlined narrative versus breaking up all the chapters and verses. And I like to read out of that in my devotions because when I'm reading the Bible, it's really hard for me to analyze it and to just enjoy it. And so for me, it's a way to do that, the Lectio Bible. So if that's you, if you seem to rabbit trail off into thoughts because of chapters and verses or footnotes, a Lectio Bible might be a good option for you for devotional purposes. So all that to say, I've been reading through Acts, and I got to Acts chapter 14, and something jumped out at me. And when something jumps out of you, it's always a good opportunity to pause and to reflect. Why is this jumping out at me and how should I respond to it? And I noticed a pattern that was written down that caught my eye. And I want to talk about that pattern. So if you don't know, at this point in time, two characters, Paul and Barnabas, by Acts chapter 14, have been sent off by the Jerusalem church to go minister to different communities around kind of the known world at this time. And they visit three communities in particular. All in chapter 14, these very Gentile communities that they go and visit. Gentile being a word that's used to differentiate between Jews and non-Jewish people. In the New Testament, they're called Gentiles. And so you have Jewish people and non-Jewish people. And so the movement of Christianity began with Jewish people. It was a Jewish movement, believing that Jesus was, in fact, their Messiah, their anointed one to come to bring about a rule and reign, which has significant implications to what we're talking about here. We'll tie all that together probably here in a little while. So they were sent out into these communities, and they happened to start teaching. And in three different instances, the writer of Acts, I believe to be Luke, but the writer of Acts highlights some specific things. And I want to look at a few of them here. So in Acts chapter 14, in verse 7, there they continued to proclaim the good news. There they continued to proclaim, which is to speak out the good news. That word there is gospel that you see. So that's in verse 7. Then again, in verse 15, at the end of verse 15, Paul and Barnabas are engaging with the people in Lystra. And he says this to them, "We are proclaiming the good news to you." So we are proclaiming the gospel to you. So that's number two in the same chapter. And then finally, in the third city that they're at, it says this in verse 21. After they had proclaimed the good news. So here we have in one chapter, three instances of the narrator, the writer, Luke, telling us that they were engaging in activity that was about proclaiming, which is to speak out the gospel. Now, what's interesting here, I think, is that there's a bit of an assumption that you know what that means. Now, if you've been following the narrative flow, for instance, if you had read Luke and you had moved into Acts, you would assume that there is a connection to Jesus, but it's not inherently clear as to what they were saying in their proclamation. All we know, according to chapter 14, is that they are proclaiming some form of gospel or good news. Now, this is just one chapter. All through Acts, you see this word happen coming up over and over and over again. And I want to explore a little bit why I think this word is important. And so to do that, we're going to do a little bit of a word study. I'm going to close my Bible here just for a second and look at some notes that I have in front of me to help navigate this conversation, because I want to be able to think through this clearly. So the first place I want to go with you is to understand where this word came from. And then we're going to maybe look at how this word was used in relationship to the Gospels, that we call the Gospels. If we have time, we'll go further, but depending on the time, we may stop there and I may pick it up later on, because I also want to look at how Jesus used this word. I want to look at how people like Peter use this word, what he thought the gospel was, what Paul thought the gospel was. And so we're going to look at different ways that it's explored. We're going to look at how this word was used in the Greco-Roman society of their day to help us maybe understand the implications of them choosing this word, which all has an intertwining connection to it. So we're going to go all over the place, and this is just going to be, hopefully you stick with me, and let's see where we land before I stop. Okay, so this word, gospel, where did this word come from? So in the Greek, there is a noun version, euangelion, and there is a verb version, which is euangelizo. So euangelion and euangelizo is the verb version of this. And what it describes is a thing, and then how to proclaim that thing. So before we get into the Gospels, and before we get into how Jesus used it and how Paul and Peter used it, I want to talk a little bit about where did this word come from? Okay, so that's a great question. It's used everywhere in the New Testament. In fact, the verb version is used 52 times. The euangelizo was used 52 times in the New Testament. But before that, it was actually used in the Greco-Roman society, in the Greco-Roman world. And I want to pull that up here for a second. I'm going to just pull up my notes. This euangelion, this noun version, had an association to the Roman Empire. So, for instance, Priene, in Asia Minor. This is around 9 BCE. So this is right about the time that Jesus is born or coming into the world, but predates him. We see this word pop up when describing the birthday of Caesar Augustus. And it says this. This is what Priene says out of Asia Minor. He says, "The birthday of the god Augustus was the beginning of the good news for the world that came through him." Okay, so what's happening here? So this writer that's writing before Jesus even comes on the earth is talking about the emperor's birthday and how his coming is in fact a gospel. And he associates this word gospel with the coming of the Caesar because for him, it is in fact good news. That's what the word means. It is an announcement, a proclamation of something that's good, that Augustus has brought peace on the earth. His birth, his coming has brought something great into the world because now look around us. We have peace. We have Pax Romana, the peace on earth. It's brought about by the rule and reign of the emperor. And this is in fact good news. Now this tells us something about the word. It doesn't tell us everything about the word, but it does tell us something. It tells us that this word gospel or good news was used before the authors of the New Testament got a hold of the word and started using it. That's important because that tells us it had a meaning. The early New Testament writers did not make up this word good news. And my belief is that they did not misassociate these two. The fact that they're using this specific word, which would have been a political word in the day that they lived, this would have been a word that was associated with the Roman Empire proclaiming something about their rule and reign, that when they say that Augustus has been born into the world, and that's good news because by his coming, his kingdom produces peace on earth. Is it any coincidence that the early New Testament writers hijacks this word and uses it for their own purpose? It's as if they take something that was known and reworks it through the message of their own story. When we communicate today in 2025 or wherever, whenever you're watching this, we use the language that is known for our day and our time. It's language is fluid. It's always changing, and we are subject to the rules of language in the world that we live at this time. And so I don't communicate the way that they did 1,000 years ago. I don't communicate anything new because there's no reason for me to, because if I'm trying to communicate with you, I'm going to use the words that are common. I'm going to do my best to communicate in a way, if I want you to receive it, by using words that are helpful for you to understand. And I think the authors of the New Testament are no different. I think they see something happening with this word, and then they have an experience with the person of Jesus, and they go, oh, this is actually connected. And so they have a common word called gospel in English, which means good news, and they hijack it to communicate something that they believe about Jesus. And this is dangerous. It's dangerous for a number of reasons. So it's dangerous because this was a political word to mean something specific about the emperors at this time. And well, it was used that way. I guess I'll go back to say this. There is evidence that there were proclamations from the Roman Empire that were good news declarations that weren't simply about the emperor and his coming to the earth, but it did have a connection to, like, there would be like a person coming into a city that was a Roman delegate, and they would, you know, gather the people together, or they would post on, you know, the city town square, an area where they might post something up there for people to see, and it would be a gospel proclaiming something good for that city to hear. So there were messages like that as well. But I do think that the gospel, or the authors of the New Testament, are being very intentional with how they use this word, meaning that it was a political statement. Because if they're saying that this is the gospel, the good news has to do with Jesus's coming. Remember back in, let me pull that up here. If you remember back into Luke chapter 2, this is important because we're connecting Acts to Luke. We're going to stay within that stream a little bit. But at the beginning, Luke starts telling a story about how Jesus came into the world. And if you look in Acts chapter 2, verse 10, it says this: "But the angel said to them, 'Do not be afraid. Listen carefully, for I proclaim to you,'" and if you're reading along with me, "'good news,'" or gospel, "'that brings great joy to all the people.'" This is that word, euangelizo, euangelizo. I proclaim. Again, it's this connection. Did you catch it in Acts chapter 14 when we were making that connection, that three times that I proclaim, I proclaim, I proclaim, euangelizo. And here we have the angel in in Luke chapter 2 starting out saying, "I come to proclaim to you the euangelizo, the gospel, the good news that brings joy to all the people." Do I think that happened? Yeah, sure. I think that happened. But I also think something much bigger is happening here that I think is super rad, which is to say that the angel is, in at least in this story, taking that word and reimagining it onto Jesus instead of Augustus. So this is really important, because this activation of the euangelizo, this proclaiming of good news, is connected to who Jesus is. And right at the beginning, Luke ties that euangelizo, that good news, to the birth of Jesus. So this word, when we begin to like work it out, here's what I think Luke is doing in Acts and in his biography. Luke is doing theology. What do I mean by that? Well, theology is what we think about God and what God is up to in our world or in the Bible. And so when we think of Luke doing theology, he is not simply telling us about events that took place. Luke's primary objective, I believe, and I think most scholars believe, is that Luke isn't trying to give us video cam footage of every little detail that took place. What Luke is trying to do here is he's trying to do theology. By Luke saying that the angel is proclaiming the euangelizo, by Paul and Barnabas proclaiming the euangelizo, the good news, they are tying directly a very political idea to the person of Jesus, that Jesus is the one who brings peace and is the one who brings good news. And here's the dangerous part. If Jesus is the one who does that, then by default, like, who isn't? Who's the one that's not doing that? It's Caesar. So you have a power struggle at play in the Gospels, because everyone in that world, in the Greco-Roman society, would say that it was the Roman Empire that brought good news. They're the ones that brought peace. I mean, if you were on their side, if you were at the back end of their sword, it was terrible. But that was what they proclaimed, the Proxy Romana, this belief that they brought peace on earth. And yet, Luke begins with an angel saying, no. I'm going to tell you that there's someone else that's actually going to bring peace on earth. And we learn through the biographies of Jesus that it is Jesus that is the one that brings good news. And so this word has a history, it has a past, and that past of the euangelizo is directly associated with how the New Testament authors choose to use this word and why it became dangerous for them to proclaim it. That is for another video. I'm going to stop here on this, and in our next video, we're going to dive into a little bit deeper on how this word is used in the New Testament, particularly with Jesus and Paul and Peter, and we'll see where we go from there. Thanks for watching the writings portion. I have some thoughts coming up. Okay, I want to talk about a little bit for the I'm just saying about the Gospels. The Gospel according to Matthew, the Gospel according to Mark, the Gospel according to Luke, John, etc. Where did these titles come from? So first off, I want to address that when these documents, these biographies were written, they were written anonymously. Okay, no one in their Gospels identifies themselves, okay? So this is really important to know is you read it. There's nowhere it says, I, John, am saying this, or I, Mark, am writing this, or Luke here, just letting you know, I'm the author here. That's not how writings were produced in the ancient world. We want to be able to say like, well, how come they didn't do that? They should have done that. That it doesn't give me confidence. And what we do when we project onto these writings our own desires is we rob it from its original place and time. You've heard me say over and over again on this episode, the Bible wasn't written to you. So it was written for you, but it wasn't written to you. So you shouldn't expect to have certain desires out of it that it's not set up to actually answer. And one of those things is we like to know when, you know, who wrote it. We want to know all the little nitty-gritty details, like why isn't his childhood talked about outside of Luke in one story and those sorts of things. It's just because that's not how ancient writings, at least biographies, were produced in the ancient world. That can be a topic for another day. So understand, first off, these titles, the Gospel of Mark, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were added later. These were later additions, these titles that were given. And so the reason why these titles were given is that as these documents began to be circulated in the ancient world, it just was important for the early church to be able to identify that these writings had what's called an apostolic voice, meaning that they were written by either a eyewitness of Jesus or a close associate of Jesus. So for instance, Mark was, as far as we know, was not a eyewitness of Jesus. Luke, as far as we know, was not an eyewitness of Jesus. So only Matthew and John actually walked with him. However, when you do background study into how these texts were originated and you read the early church fathers, you learn stories about how Mark traveled with Peter to Rome and how that's how that work was produced. So when you read Mark's gospel, you're probably reading Peter's account of his time with Jesus. Luke was someone who interviewed all the eyewitnesses and got firsthand account. That's talked about in Luke chapter 1 in his opening stance. He talks about how after he interviewed everyone or talked to the eyewitnesses. And so there's direct correlation there. But they were attributed later on. When they were first attributed, they always had this, according to Mark, the euangelion, according to Luke, the euangelion. And so it was like, according to Mark, the gospel, the good news, this proclamation, right? And so then it's the story, the biography, the story of this good news. What is this good news about? But these things were given later. And then as English translations began to circulate, it used to be the according to Mark, according to Matthew. Then you have attributed to it according to the euangelion or according according to, and that sort of thing. And then later on, as English translations begin to pop up, they begin to use this word gospel. And then that's just kind of what sticks. And so a question could be asked. You hear me all the time talk about, I like to say biographies personally. So whenever I talk about these, I say the biography according to Mark or Mark's biography of Jesus. Now, I just do that intentionally because I like to help people think of these things as a story about Jesus's life. Do I believe they have agendas? Absolutely. Do I think they're biographies like we have biographies today? Certainly not. All of these things play in. I just think for me, and this is just me, I think the word gospel is for people who are kind of just with faith. They just have been there, done that. You know, they've been preaching the gospel at me. I just try to remove those kinds of buzzwords out of my own lexicon so I can have better conversations with people. The reason why your Bibles don't call them biographies is because they are attributed with the desire. They are written through the lens to give you a message about the good news about Jesus. They are, in essence, the proclamation of Jesus's good news, his euangelion, or they are literally biographies of euangelizo, which is the verb action, right? These biographies ought to lead you to a place where you actually can wrestle with learning to trust Jesus or making a decision to trust Jesus. These writings have agendas. They're meant to lead you to a place where you are actually questioning whether or not you want to follow this guy named Jesus, and for you to see that trusting him is in fact good news. And so maybe the best title that we could give these four biographies is we would say maybe Mark's biography of good news, or you know, Luke's biography of the euangelizo. Whatever. I just, you know, does that matter? I don't know. But I just wanted to give you a little background. Like, why do we have these titles? Where did that come from? They weren't original to the text. They were added later so that they could be attributed to gain greater authority as they were passed around in the early church. They were originally titled according to Mark, according to John, added on the euangelion later. And then in its English began to take on the gospel, just kind of took prominence within how we think about these things. And all that is to say that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are attempting to share with you the euangelizo, the good news, proclaiming to you the good news of who Jesus is. And that's the four gospels. Okay, now we're talking about comments on your comments. This is a favorite of people's I'm hearing. And today we've got a couple that I want to highlight and talk about. The first one is going to be from Point Break 2811. Point Break 2811. This was on a video called "Feel Like You Don't Belong in Church? You Might Be Closer to Jesus Than You Think." This is a video I made where I explored what it feels like to be on the outside from like religious systems. And Point Break 2811 made a comment that just sat with me, and I want to share some thoughts about this. So he said this, or she said this, I really don't know. "I just quit church. People are judgmental." All right. Well, a couple things on that. Let's start with the back end. People are judgmental. You're right. Absolutely 100%. People make judgments all the time. In fact, I would argue maybe Point Break, you make judgments too towards people. The challenge that we have is that we want to say of ourselves that that shouldn't happen in church. Like, this is the idea that, well, we shouldn't be judgmental. Jesus said, right? Do not judge, lest you be judged. He does this in Matthew. He talks about it in Luke. And this idea that, like, we should never judge. I want to challenge that notion. That is that what Jesus is actually talking about? This notion that we can't make judgments towards things. I don't think it's that plain. But let me get to this. Here's the reality. Everywhere you go, judgments are happening all the time, all around you. It doesn't mean it's fair. It doesn't mean it's always good. And sometimes maybe it is good. But especially when we get to church and we find that people are judging us, this can be really frustrating. And I want to maybe bring some clarity as to why this happens. Remember, I've been in pastoral ministry for 23 years in leadership, and there's a lot that I've seen throughout the years. And so I want to maybe share some perspective as to why we experience this. And this isn't to justify to say that it's good. But here's the belief system that happens in Christianity. So as a Christian, we believe that Jesus is Lord, and that our response to him being Lord is to repent for the ways that we have gone about doing his way wrong, call it sin. And so we repent and we believe that he forgives us of that. And then he invites us into relationship with him and with God and his Spirit. And that ought to launch us into a new way of existing and being. And this is kind of the trajectory of like the New Testament. People going, okay, Jesus is going to be my Lord. Because he's my Lord, I need to ask for forgiveness for the ways that I've done it wrong. And then I need to realign myself to the ways that we should do it, which is what the story of Jesus is all about. He is the example of how to do that. Okay, so what happens is that in these church communities, there are people that take very seriously the role of, how to say this nicely, they take very seriously the role of determining who's in and who's out. They take very seriously drawing the lines of what's acceptable and not acceptable by, and their intentions, I don't know that their intentions are bad. I guess I would never say that someone that's drawing that line that's saying, you have to get over here. I think deep down, even though I would disagree with their method, their deep down is probably because they desire something good. They believe that what is on their side of the line is actually good for you and not simply good. It's what God wants you to do. And this is an interesting place to get as a Christian, where we get to a point where we think that we so concretely know what God wants exactly, that then we move into a place where we actually act as God on God's behalf. And we justify these behaviors by the prophets. We go, oh, in the Old Testament, they had these prophets, and they, the ones that were speaking out on these things. And all I'm trying to say with that is that I'm trying to help you understand how people get there. It starts typically with a desire to do good. Then it moves into a place of fear and protection. And then that fear and protection leads people to draw lines. And then when they see people on the outside of those lines that are supposed to be a part of their faith tradition, they believe it's their job to police that, either get out or get in. That's the trajectory. It starts out well-intended. Man, I love Jesus. I really care about people. I want to see people live for him. Then we struggle because we see ways in which people are doing it differently than what we think or our tradition thinks. Then we begin to want to protect God from these things or protect the church from these things. We begin to draw lines. We begin to ask people to either be on this side or that side. And ultimately, when people feel on the outside, they go, I don't want nothing to do with this. And that's probably where I think you got to, which is the first part of your statement. I quit church. I just quit. And I just want to say I'm sorry. I want to say I'm sorry, Point Break 2811. I'm sorry for the ways in which people looked at you, treated you, acted towards you, and it made you feel like other. Now, I'm not justifying behavior, or I don't know your situation that caused people to act and interact with you the way that they did. I just want you to know this, and we say this on this channel, we don't judge Jesus by the abuse done in his name. God has a good story, and he still has a place in it for you. So I hope that one day you can see that people are just humans. Everyone judges. There are no perfect Christians. And sometimes that's pointed to you, and that's unfortunate. But we don't want to judge Jesus because of the abuse in his name. The church, the church, the collection of God's people that come together in worship and in sacrament together to honor Jesus as King, is still a worthwhile pursuit. And when you're ready, I hope you reach out to me and I can help you find some resources to get you connected. So that's comment on your comments. I'll leave it for that for now because the video is going long. We'll jump into other ones in future videos. Thanks for leaving your comments. Please continue to do so. And maybe your comment, good or bad, will be featured on this video, on a video like this in the future. All right, folks, that does it for Whiskey in the Writings today. Remember, we have another video coming up on the gospel. We're going to continue this conversation going forward. But listen, if you're here and you're wrestling, you're spiritually curious, you still want to believe, but maybe you're just not sure about how you used to, I want you to know this. Never forget it. God has a good story, and there's still a place in it for you. He's not done with you. Let's not judge Jesus by the abuse done in his name. Let's investigate him for who he is and what he has for you. Thank you for joining me on Whiskey in the Writings, and we'll see you next time.